Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Tell us about shampoo bars.
Okay, anyway. So one of my clients the other day asked me about shampoo bars. And I said, well, it just kind of depends on which one you're looking at, you know? And she was like, well, just in general. And I said, well, just like any shampoo, you should be looking at your ingredients. And then, like, so, say you get one and you try it and you don't like the way it makes your hair feel, don't keep using it.
Yeah.
Or if you see all your color going down the drain, don't keep using it. But am I opposed to shampoo bars or conditioner bars? Absolutely not. Whatever works for you is whatever works for you. And if that is a way that you would like to reduce waste for the environment, I'm here for it. But just pay attention to the health of your hair and your scalp.
Something new that I've never seen before, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, Kenra just came out with powder shampoo and conditioner.
Like, do you use it in the shower, or is it, like, dry shampoo?
I think you use it in the shower, I'm pretty sure.
You make sure it's, like, you know, powdered laundry detergent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there are different options now. I don't know any... Do you know any professional brand shampoo bars?
I don't think that I do off the top of my head. Paul Mitchell might be one that would have one.
I think
you know
they do.
Like the Agua Pui line.
And I think there is one in that line, I'm pretty sure, in the green packaging.
That's what, there's most definitely a tea tree exfoliating bar.
Yeah.
I know that much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not opposed to a shampoo bar. I know Lush makes some shampoo
That's
bars.
The first one that came to my head
Does
when you said it.
Does make shampoo bars? I know they make facial soap, and I know
I'm
they
not
make,
sure.
Like, you know, all kinds of body soap, but...
I'm not sure.
They make lip soaps.
So,
Here we are, talking about Buff City again.
If you use shampoo bars all the time while you're camping at any point, and you have reviews, I've never used one, so tell us.
They also make, like, biodegradable shampoo sheets where, like, you get it with your hand and you lather it, and then you use it. I've used those, like, backpacking or whatever, but, yeah, if you use a bar, let us know which one and if you like it.
Sheets like that? I've seen those for, like, your face, too.
Yeah, you can get them for almost, like, a lot of companies are making them for travel now with all kinds of different products.
Yeah.
Like face cleanser or, and, like.
That's super convenient. I've never used shampoo bar, so I'll be interested to see.
I have never used shampoo bar. Nope, 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 nope.
Me neither.
Nope.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
So anyway, State Line Mob.
Oh yeah, part two.
Yes, that was a doozy. If you haven't listened to part one, this is our first part one and two.
Look at her go.
But if you haven't listened to part one, you probably should, because even if we do a quick little recap now, there is no way that it could even begin to cover. The State Line Club, long story short, they were continuously in the news. There were raids. You have Doris and Jack who kept opening the club. Louise, who walked around with a ball peen hammer in her. Yeah. So there was just a lot going on. In January 1956, a young 22-year-old sailor came in and asked for a Coke and a hamburger. So Luis sends this little young waitress about his age over to serve him, and he's, like, downing drinks. In the book I read, it comments on the fact this man was, like, sucking down Cokes and ordering them.
Okay.
So after four or five Cokes.
With cocaine in these Coca-Colas at the time.
1950. They would have been in glass bottles then, right? Like, they didn't fill up cups like that back then.
No, I think 50s it probably, yeah. Glass
bottle. But... Well, he was slurping them down. Miranda's getting her phone. She's like, hold on, let's Google this. I think that might have been like early 1900s because cocaine had to be getting expensive by this point, right?
Well, and I think it was debunked as like a
health thing.
Yeah, it's like a medicine.
1929. Well, makes sense. That's what the problem in Phoenix City was. They had cocaine coke.
Cocaine coke.
Toehead comes over and he's like, hey, you know, you want to come shoot some crap? At first, the young waitress is like, no, I don't know if you should. But then she starts like rubbing his shoulders and she is like, oh, you know, come on. I'll be your good luck charm. And he was like, no, I need to get on the road, but I'm waiting for a friend. And Toehead put a beer bottle in front of the sailor and was like, no, come on, let's go play dice. The sailor says, nope, I don't gamble. I'm just here to pick up a friend. So Louise comes over and she starts baiting him. And she's like, oh, church boy. Oh, okay. So while the pressure increased on the sailor, two teenage boys, Buford Pusser and Marvin King, come walking in. They order two beers like it's nothing. Buford Pusser is 6'6".
Yeah.
So he drinks his beer real quick. Toehead's still fucking with the sailor, being like, come on. And the young waitress is like, what's your name? And he says, Kenneth McCoy. Just then, Toehead comes in and he starts pushing the guy. And he's like, come on, what are you made of? Come on. I'm a tough guy, a toughie. Buford was just watching, kind of staying out of it because Buford's dad, Carl, had been the police chief in Adamsville for like forever. So he's like, I'm not going to get involved with this. And him and his friends are even, look how cool this place is. This is awesome. So they're dancing with girls and they didn't know that the girls were actually picking their pockets while they were dancing with them. So he's like, all right, this smokes too much. The girl's like, let's go back to my trailer. And he's like, okay, no, not really. I'm just going to go outside, get some air. So he comes back inside. He sits down and then all hell fucking breaks loose. The sailor's still sitting there. And Toehead, out of nowhere, just attacks him from behind. And this sailor starts kicking Toehead's ass. Louise comes and boom, hits the sailor in the head with a hammer. The sailor, blood goes everywhere, covers everybody. Everything was crazy. Right then, the sheriff walks in and says, what happened here? And Louise replied, he couldn't hold his liquor and fell down. So Pusser and his friends are like, let's get the fuck out of here. They killed him. Yeah. They go back home. They're like, leave us out of this. So the man goes to the hospital and they actually ended up sending him to a hospital in Memphis because, I mean, he was fucked up. He was bad. The sheriff tells her, you better watch who you hurt because the military will come after you and they will not stop. He was right. The Navy sent a captain in to investigate. And after talking with Kenneth McCoy, he went to talk to the sheriff. And was like, you know, let me see the document on the report. And the sheriff said, I haven't completed it yet. The captain walked around and leaned over to the sheriff and said, you have 24 hours or you will be investigated for interfering with this. So the sheriff's like, shit, I've got to do something. And he goes back to the bar and he's talking to Toehead. He goes back and he files assault and battery charges. The Navy personnel comes in and says that should actually be first degree assault and battery, a felony charge. They did a blood test on the sailor. He had no alcohol in his system. So, I mean, obviously there's them saying him just falling down drunk. That doesn't work.
Right. Like, come on now.
Well,
there's a hole in his head.
Right. What would happen normally is the Hathcocks would have these people removed that are injured off the property and just pay whatever little doctor they had would pay for everything themselves. So a lot of this stuff always went under reported. Nobody ever talked about it.
Under the rug.
Right. This is the first time that this was like a big deal. Since the Navy was involved, the FBI got involved and they found two witnesses that told what happened to the sailor. And Toehead was found guilty of assault and battery. He was given 6 months in county jail and a $2,500 fine, but he got it out in 30 days. At the end of that summer, Buford Pusser had been working on this pipeline all summer in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and he didn't learn his lesson the first time and comes home and starts saying, hey, let's go to the state line. Let's have fun. He calls his friend Marvin, the one that he was with last time. Yeah. Marvin had other plans, so he was like, no, thank you. So Buford goes by himself. And on the way there, he stops to get gas and runs into this man named James Callens. He says, where are you going? And Buford says, I'm going to the plantation club. James Callens says, no, let's go to state line. The girls are better. Like, let's go there. Let's go there.
Okay.
And Buford's like, fuck that. Like, I've been
I've been there and I watched the guy get killed.
Right. He's like, I'm not fucking going there. So he drops the guy off in the parking lot of Jack's House of Suds, and he goes on to the plantation club. When he's walking in, there was some girls that were like, hey, do you know, you want some company? And he said, nope, no, thank you. Maybe later. So he goes in and he's served by this little redheaded waitress named Betty Jean. He was asking her, how do I get involved in these dice games? How do I get involved in these dice games? And she's like, don't do that. Yeah, you don't do that. You don't do that. So the dice thrower,
she said, you are a nice young man.
Don't yeah, she's like, I'm trying to help you out. So the dice thrower, Bobby, mentioned to Betty Jean to bring him another drink, and they were going to start throwing dice. Pusser starts winning. He's getting good. He's got an extra $150. Betty Jean keeps bringing him drinks, and everything's just going good, going fine. Until Bobby gave a little, like, wave to Betty Jean.
Uh-oh.
And she brought Buford a drink that time, but now she's kind of rubbing up against his body and kind of being very friendly. Since he was too drunk to notice and his eyes were on her, not the game, they switched the dice and he started just losing everything he had. He was just drunk enough and just big enough that he thought he was going to be able to confront the man shooting dice with him and be like, hey, you've changed these dice out.
And unfortunately, that's not how that works.
Right. Because three men with pool cues started attacking him and beating the absolute shit out of him. I mean,
and he's also drunk.
Absolutely. And he literally loses consciousness. They beat him so bad. And once he's unconscious, they go through his pockets and, you know, completely rob him. Then they drag him out the back door into the rain, across the muddy parking lot, and rolled him into the drainage ditch just a few feet from his car.
They were going to drown him.
Yeah, they were just going to leave him there. Betty Jean goes running out there. And so she's like struggling to move his body. I mean, this man's 6'6", and she's like a small woman.
Yeah.
So she looks up and walking across from Jack's House of Suds to the plantation club is James Callens, the guy that he had just given the ride to. So she calls him over. She's fucking freaking out. And she's like, you know, please help. So he goes in Buford's pockets to get his car keys. And they're gone. So they drove him. Yeah. So they drag him up next to the car. And James got a pocket knife and put in the ignition until it started. And as they were putting him in the back seat, W.O., who is Jack's nephew, who was running Jack's House of Suds at the time, comes out. And he tells Billy Jean, you know, you better get back to work. And he pulls out his pistol and tells James to get off the property, and James just floors it and gets fucking out of there. Betty Jean goes back into work. Callens got to a store, and when he pulled over, he found some rags, and he put pressure on Buford's head and his forehead. He starts up the road and realizes he is not doing good. So he stops at a different store and bangs on the door, because back then they would like live over their stores. So he bangs on the door until this man named Alan comes and answers the door. They get him to the clinic. They work on him and he lives. He gets 192 stitches.
Dang.
Yeah. I mean, they almost killed him. Had she not been there, he would be dead. So James Callen just goes home in Buford's car. Like, he's like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. And Buford's parents show up to get him, and his eyes are black and swollen shut. I mean, he is bad. Carl, the dad, who, if we remember, is the police chief in Adamsville, has been for a million years, calls Sheriff Kirby, and he's like, you know, have you heard about this? Sheriff Kirby obviously is like, oh, no, no clue. The dad then drives to James's house and asks him for details. The sheriff goes down to the plantation club, finds no signs of the struggle. It had been raining, so all the blood's washed away. W.O. won't answer. Nothing to see. Nothing ever happens on his side. Next day, Carl is talking to Sheriff Taylor, who was on the Tennessee side, and mm-hmm. he's telling him what happened. And Sheriff Taylor also said that, well, your son was breaking the law by drinking. So what am I supposed to do? Carl Pussard, Buford's dad, went down to the plantation club with his 12-gauge shotgun, and he blasted out the windows of W.O.'s new car and then shot out the club's windows one by one. As he drove away, he smiled and waved to W.O., who was standing in the middle of the road looking at him. Right after this happened, Buford joined the Marine Corps because this he needed. Get him the fuck out of here. 6 months after Betty Jean witnessed the brutal beating, she vanished. Her body turned up 2 years later, some distance away in Corinth. It was identified from dental records, and her skull had a bullet in the back, and the death was ruled a suicide.
In the back?
Mm-hmm. To celebrate the new year of 1957, Towhead decided to take a little trip with a couple of his buddies, Jack Newton and Nimbo Price, to Mississippi.
Nimbo?
Nimbo. They pulled into a little mom and pop store for gas and cigarettes on their way, and because Towhead is truly a heinous person, he pulled out a small 32 caliber automatic pistol from under his seat and stuck it in his pants. And while him and Nimbo splintered the back door, they practically knocked it off its fucking hinges. He was slowly creeping towards the front while Price guarded the door, and he knocked over a can of peas on the way. So as he crept closer to the cash register, he pulled a screwdriver from his pants to jimmy it open. Then he heard a safety switch click. The impact flung his body like a rag doll completely across the store countertop. Jack barely made it to the floor, and Nimbo fucking just boop out of there.
He gone.
Yep. They left without Towhead and went to get Jack Hathcock. So obviously police were called. They removed Towhead's wallet and found his ID, found his police. And he had actually been arrested in Arkansas just a few weeks before for a burglary charge, but let go. So he ended up having to go in for surgery, and they had to work on his left side, side of his body, mm-hmm. his arm, his leg, and his face for several hours, removing buckshot and like closing gaping wounds.
Oh, so he got shot with a shotgun.
Yeah. Like, it's a miracle.
That's why he was like,
yeah. It's a miracle he even lived. This surgery took 8 hours. Then they moved him to Memphis in serious condition, and they had a deputy posted outside of his room. They actually found out that he had been charged with desertion from both the Army and the Air Force at one point and given a dishonorable discharge. He had been a suspect for home invasions all over, burglaries. Like, that was his. That was his thing. And one thing that you learn with most of these stories that was true in Phoenix City, it's here, it'll be true for Dixie Mafia, is this is never, they don't call themselves the State Line Mob. Obviously, the newspapers call them the State Line Mob. And they weren't some syndicate the way that, like, the Italians were, to where you had these familial ties and there was like this hierarchy.
These mob bosses, it's just if you had a club and you were operating.
Right. And then like you were good at like theft. So that's what you did, the bank robberies. And I was good at prostitution. So I did the prostitution.
Yeah, you ran the brothel.
Right. And like this guy was really good. And
this guy ran the bar. This guy ran the club.
Right.
This guy ran the gambling.
And that's kind of how they made a web out of this. And that's what makes this so fascinating is whenever you talk about the Dixie Mafia, you know, people think of like this crime syndicate and they think of, oh yeah, my papa was in the Dixie Mafia. Well, there were dozens of Dixie Mafias. There were an infinite amount. Every little town that you had a Dixie Mafia. Yeah, right. Had
somebody who was doing something.
Right. So he just, that was his thing. And Jack and Louise arrived at the hospital 4 days later, and they actually went and bought a cherry red 1955 Chevy two-door coupe. Louise drove it back to the hospital as Jack followed her, and she parked the car under a large oak tree facing, like, his hospital room. He was supposed to get out, but then he had, like, a really bad lung infection, and it kind of delayed it a little bit. Well, you've got to think, whenever he's released, he's going to be released to the authorities.
Yeah.
So they don't want that to happen. But they snuck food into him. They couldn't take clothes in because there's a deputy outside his room. So they're like, no, we don't trust that. You're not bringing that in. So Louise goes to a nurse down the hall and she pulls out a wad of $100 bills and gives them to the nurse. And the nurse is like, that's more money than I'm making a year. Louise says, I'll give you double that if you get my friend out of here. She's like, listen, we bought him these clothes. They won't let us give him these clothes. And the nurse is like, I'll take care of this. You know, he's going to be dismissed Sunday morning. I got it. So that afternoon, the nurse went to the doctor's lounge and took scrubs, a jacket, stethoscope, shoes, a clipboard and cap, and then a key. And she put them in a cabinet under the sink. She told Towhead that he had to leave through 102 through the bathroom that connected to 104. That's where everything was underneath, and he needed to be really, really quiet. Then he needs to sneak from there to the storage room. When he gets to the storage room, there's a lock on the back door. There's a key, take it. You only have between 4 and 6 a.m. when there's no guard at your door, or they're going to catch you doing it. You're scheduled to be out of here by 10 a.m., so you need to get out of here, like, whenever that guard's not here. This is your only chance. So Towhead does exactly that. He dresses up like the doctor. He sneaks out, gets out to the car, and gets in the Chevy. 4 hours later, he was in Texarkana. By the time the sheriff learned that he was gone, he was already long gone.
Yeah, he's already out uptown.
So in the trunk, he found a note in Louise's handwriting in a trunk. And in the trunk, he found cans of food, a suitcase, money, and a fifth of whiskey. He calls Jack and he lets him know, like, hey, where I'm supposed to be, I'm good. And he gets a little bit flirty with the waitress and slips her his room number. Later on, she comes to his room and she's like, listen, you need to get the fuck out of here. Your picture is all over TV.
People looking for you.
Yeah, like, people want to know where you are. Here's a map to my parents' cabin in Texas that doesn't get used that much. There's food there. You don't have to go in public. Go. So he loads up the Chevy and he heads down and follows the map to the cabin in the countryside. And he unpacked the Chevy and made himself a little bit comfortable. For some reason, that's when he starts hitchhiking from the cabin back to Texarkana. I don't know why he would do that, because then a Texas Ranger, who immediately asked him for an ID, took him to the ranger station, but he didn't have any identification on him. He was let go, even though his wanted poster was in the police station. 4 months later, they finally caught Towhead, and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for the store burglary and 2 more years for another burglary. So Jack and Louise is married, doing good. He's still trying to buy her love, and it's just not working for him. So Jack goes to see if this man named Frank Hughes wants to buy the 45 grill to make it to a truck stop, because he's thinking, you know, I'm hoping that I can save my marriage and have a little bit left over. Let's get rid of this place. It's costing us too much stress. So while he's off meeting with this guy, Louise calls Pee Wee Walker and asks if he wants to get away for the weekend. Frank finally takes Jack up on his offer to buy the 45 grill. The next day, whole place burns. Jack goes back to Frank and he's like, listen, do you want me to buy it back? Just give you back your money and I'll buy it back. Frank's like, okay, here we go. Land is yours again. Jack decides that he wants to look into a franchise motel called the Shamrock Motel for $10,000 yearly membership fee and $40,000 for the franchise package. He actually did it all. He chose the big package, which included all the motel signs, the equipment, and everything. But he didn't have the money to do it because all of his money was tied up in land. So he goes to his best friend, Pee Wee, to ask if he could borrow the money. Pee Wee let him, and the Shamrock started its construction. Louise actually got really excited, but she was like, I don't really want to be with Jack anymore, but I really like these, like, business opportunities that come with Jack. But her and Pee Wee straight up just weren't hiding it. They were being affectionate to each other around other people, and Jack started to pick up what the fuck was going on. So one day he started to walk out of the house and he noticed that there was a pack of matches with the White House hotel icon on it. And he was like, where the fuck did she get these from? Slip them in his pocket, light up a cigar, leave. Pee Wee was telling Jack that the House of Suds had failed inspection and they weren't going to renew their business license. And he got out a cigarette and he lit it with a book of matches that said White House Hotel, the same matches. And Jack knew instantly what the fuck was going on. He overhears her talking sweet on the phone with someone. He picks it up. She hangs it. He's like, who the fuck are you talking to? Who was that? And she slaps him and like knocks him back against the wall. And he punches her. Blood's pouring from her nose. They get into an all-out brawl. And they just stop when they hear the baby crying. They just stop. Jack opened the bedroom door. As he did that, he heard the distinct cock sound of a trigger as Louise tried to shoot him in the face. She made him lay face down on the floor while she gathered clothing for herself and Susan, then grabbed Susan up, ran out the door. He jumped in his car and tried to chase her, but she showed up at her brother's house. And she told her brother basically that everything had happened in reverse. That Jack was the aggressor, that Jack had held her at gunpoint. So her brother was like, you can stay here as long as you want. She even went to an attorney to be like, you know, hey, I don't want to be married to this guy anymore. Well, Pee-wee stopped by Jack's house and was like, hey, can you pay me back that money that you borrowed from me? And Jack just kind of made excuses, which was like not like Jack, but okay, whatever.
Right.
So one day, Bobby Floyd stopped by Jack's house and was like, hey, just so you know, Louise is at her brother's house. And I heard Pee-wee telling Howard Carroll this over at the plantation. So that just seals it for Jack. He's like, okay, so how do you know where my wife is? But I don't. And you're my best friend. So you've not even told me where my wife is.
Don't love that.
Right. So like he seals the deal. He knows that it's Pee-wee. And he even finds out that they had like been taking trips together. So when she would just up and leave the baby and disappear and go out of town, she would be with Pee-wee. Now Nelson Timlake has to get involved and he's been doing intel on Louise and he knows everything that's going on. He tells Jack, he's like, you've got fucking issues. Louise has done this before. She's doing it again. She is threatening our empire and you need to handle it.
Right.
And you need to handle Pee-wee. Louise stops by his ex-wife's house and she's like, hey, will you run out and get some milk for the girls? As he's out getting the milk for the girls, this car pulls up and there's just like 3 men in it. And they're like, hey, we want to buy some liquor from you. We want liquor from you. But we need you to get in the car with us because we have to go get our truck to haul the liquor. So Pee-wee starts to get into the car. And when he leans down, he sees Albert McDonald. And he's like, aren't you one of Nelson Timlake's guys? Like, what are you doing with these guys? Aren't you Nelson Timlake's guy? Mm-hmm. In the Stewie voice like I just used right then. And the guy says, yes, among other things, today appears to be one of those other things. And Pee-wee's like, all right, bet. So he gets in the car with him. He starts noticing. He was like, Bobby, why is your truck this way? Like, you never park over here. That's weird. And they all pull up to a small pond and they get out of the car. And Pee-wee starts to say, what's going on here? But he can't finish because he's punched in the head with brass knuckles, dropping him down to his knees.
Oh, okay.
So they proceeded to beat and kick Pee-wee for several minutes until he was just pouring blood. When they asked where Louise was, he refused to tell them.
The tale.
And they literally beat him until he confessed, like, she's at her brother's house. And as soon as he did, they shot him in the back of the head. They left him exactly where they shot him. They washed up in the pond. They loaded up in the car and they left. Meanwhile, Jack and Nelson were sitting at the Dixie Cafe having breakfast in a public place where people would see them.
Yeah.
And around 10:15, they drove up to Jackson in a public place where people would see them. And then Jack returned to the Shamrock Motel. While he's at the Shamrock checking the progress, one of the workers says, have you seen Pee-wee? And he says, no, but if you do, tell him I'm looking for him. At 4 p.m., fishermen went to his favorite fishing hole where he found Pee-wee Walker's body. After a thorough investigation, the sheriff narrowed down a list of what originally was 11 suspects to 4. Bobby Floyd, DeWitt Curtis, Jack Hathcock, and Herschel Roberts. They took them all in for first-degree murder, and their bonds were set at $5,000 apiece. They all kind of laughed off the interrogations. They all failed the lie detector test, but they stuck by their alibis. Jack would bail out, and he would go home feeling no remorse. He didn't have to pay back that $25,000 that he borrowed from Pee-wee. And he had killed the friend that betrayed him. So he saw that killing, literally, no pun intended, two birds with one stone. So, right. The funeral was arranged and Jack Hathcock and all of his men went. So after it was over, Effie, Pee-wee's mother, said that she wants to go back to the graveside, and his ex-wife and mother show up to find 2 dozen black roses resting on top, and they knew it was from Louise. His wife literally threw that shit. His mother had it burned. The family ended up getting harassed with phone calls and their house got shot up. They ended up moving. Louise knew Jack did it and she wouldn't have it anymore. She wanted a divorce. And she actually said at one point that Pee-wee was her actual true love.
Oh, damn.
He finally said that he would get a divorce, but Louise wanted 10% of the net profits from the Shamrock and $500 a month for her and Susan. She wanted to live at the Shamrock. So cottage one became hers. The Shamrock ended up opening. Their divorce is final, but they're still working together. And Jack is still hopelessly in love with this woman. The new motel was 2 miles north of Corinth, and it was right on the state line. It had 18 units besides the office and a restaurant. And there was a little rock paved walkway out to the pool and picnic area. Half of it sat on Tennessee and half of it sat on Mississippi.
Oh, that's cute.
Jack ended up just leasing it to Louise because he's like, I can't work with her anymore. For 7 years they were doing it and everything was good. They brought in several $1,000 a week because they would actually drug the tourist, and then while they were sleeping they would rob them. By June 1962, two of Jack's clubs were forcibly condemned. It was the House of Suds and the Rainbow Room, and they were going to get torn down, but Jack didn't give a shit. He let it get torn down, and on the side of the House of Suds, he actually rebuilt something else and called it Jack's Place, but didn't really worry about a beer license for a while. He just did his thing. Well, he hired a young girl named Iris White, and him and Iris fell deep in love. Like, he had been looking for this affection. She was 24 years younger than him. He was so excited about it, and he ended up renaming the place White Iris. Until Louise drove by and she saw that sign and she said, no, the fuck, I'm not. She pulled in and drug Iris outside and they got into a cat fight. Nobody would break it up, not even Jack. They just let them fight it out. Just like, ooh, this is scary shit. Louise was pissed. She wasn't having it. And she got a phone call of somebody telling her that Iris's daddy was an attorney and very religious. And so she called her daddy. She let him know that his daughter was, this is the exact words, banging a man that was 43 years old. Her dad called a judge, and the judge denied the beer license and food license and was like, nope. So Jack ended up breaking it up. He was like, this isn't worth getting fucked up over. By 1963, Buford Pusser was a constable for Adamsville. And he starts riding along on these raids to the Shamrock Motel. Because you've got to remember, he's got it out for these people. He had all that bad shit happen when he was younger. He's ready to take them down. And there's actually a couple times that him and his dad get in trouble for going on raids that they don't even have warrants to. Buford Pusser has a hard-on for these people. He's wanting to take them down. And by March 28th, 1964, he was put as the Republican candidate for the McNary County Sheriff. At the same time, Jack had come to the conclusion that he is ready to change his will and his lease agreement with Louise. Like, Louise is getting real crazy. He just really wants to back off from it. Well, when he sits down to talk to his lawyer, he finds out that the Shamrock is $92,878 behind and has tax liens on it. The only way to really do anything is to pay that lien off. And he's saying, I don't want Louise to get shit. I want Susan and her husband and her baby to get everything. The lawyer's like, that's really dangerous. But Jack says, you're going to keep it between you and I. Well, Louise ends up finding out about it because the secretary called up to the Shamrock Motel and says, hey, I want to talk to Jack. Well, the secretary handed the phone to Louise because Jack doesn't work there, right? And Louise is like, why do you want to talk to Jack? She says, please have Jack bring the last statement from the state on the liens and taxes owed on the Shamrock. Louise is like, why? The fucking secretary says so he can get his will changed. And Louise is like, nope, nope, nope. So Louise turns to Towhead, and he had just gotten out of prison. She says that, hey, we're going to fucking kill Jack. And when we kill Jack, you're going to get the White Iris. Louise also called up W.O. Hathcock, who, if you remember from last episode, is Jack's nephew that said that he was going to get revenge against Jack one day. He had tried to open clubs next door to Jack. They'd get burned down. So this was going to be his thing, right? So W.O., they're all sitting around having a conversation, and she says, we're going to fucking kill him, and I'm going to give you his clubs as a form of payment. So they decide that Towhead's going to be the one that's going to kill him, and it's going to look like self-defense. Buford isn't elected yet, and Buford's running against Sheriff Dickey. And Sheriff Dickey is also doing the bang bang with Louise. So they have this big election party one night, and after, Louise calls and she says, come on over for a nightcap. Around 9:45 that night, Sheriff Dickey stopped by for the romantic nightcap with her. And as soon as he left, a man named Red slipped into the bedroom. They dimmed the light, and he beat the shit out of Louise until she told him to stop. Towhead and Carol then came in the room, and Louise sent Carol off to fetch Jack and told him not to mention the way that she looked. Jack was sitting in the bar having a cigarette, and he said, hey, cabin one, Louise needs to talk to you. As he was walking down the hallway of her cottage, Jack was shot 5 times. He staggered out of the cottage into the parking lot, bleeding profusely. Louise ran over to him, and all he said to her is why, as he laid crying and bleeding. She bent over, and she took off his wedding ring that he refused to take off after the divorce, took every dollar he had, and said, this is to clean up the mess you made tonight. Jack died in the parking lot. 20 minutes later, they called Sheriff Dickey. And when he shows up, he sees these bruises on her. She says, you know, Jack was trying to rape me. He beat the shit out of me. Look at me. But the sheriff noticed, you remember he had been there earlier in the night. He noticed that there was a different brand of cigarette butts in the ashtray than what were there earlier. So he actually filed first degree murder charges on her. She bailed out immediately. W.O. came and bailed her out. $5,000 bail. And she went home. She was going to call Susan, right as Susan called in the pulled in the driveway. And the first thing Susan said to her was, you killed my father, you bitch. Jack and Pee-wee were actually buried in the same cemetery. Louise paid for the funeral with the money that she took off of Jack as he lay dying in the parking lot. At the funeral, Nelson was slipped a note with 4 names on it. Susan came home to a piece of paper saying from the attorney saying, you need to get in touch with me. Well, he told her, you get ready because your mom and you don't get everything. We're actually splitting and it's about to be a real nasty legal battle. So get ready for that. And Susan hated her mom. So she knew this. She wasn't going to make this easy. They sat down and decided Towhead was to be over the Shamrock. Red Brewer was over the White Iris. And at this time, Clyde Timlake, Nelson's son, comes and he sits down at the table and he looks at Towhead and he's like, what's up, partner? And Towhead's like, what do you mean, partner? You guys paid Jack off. And Clyde looks at him and says, no, you killed him before we could, partner. Guess what? Uh-oh. This isn't going to work the way you thought it was. He looked at Louise and said, and if you cheat me, don't worry, you'll get to be with Pee-wee. So Louise goes and she's searching Jack's home for more cash when Susan, the daughter, shows up and they literally get into a fist fight. Susan and her husband go to look for Nelson, but Nelson's already out of town. So then Louise decides to go to the lawyer's office to cash in on the death. And they let her know that because of all those tax liens, it was going to be a year or more before they could get anything. So she went to the bank to withdraw the $10,765 he had, only to find out that the IRS had taken it because of the tax lien. So a few days later, Towhead was arrested for a different warrant out of Mississippi, and she went and she bailed him out. She's at the Shamrock, and Sheriff Dickey stops by. Whenever Towhead walks in and sees Sheriff Dickey leaving, he backhanded Louise, grabbed her, pushed her off the floor to where her feet were dangling, and said that if she ever saw Dickey again, she would break his neck. Oh my. So Sheriff Dickey was actually being investigated by the TBI and ATF, not only for being involved with the state liners, but because him and his wife also had a moonshine still and a bar. August 1st, 1968, the car he had borrowed from his brother-in-law blew a right front tire, causing him to go across the road into a line of trees where a state trooper would find his crushed body. So according to officials, he would have been elected, but he would have been indicted the same day. Buford Pusser was sworn into office. Right after Buford Pusser was sworn in, Towhead and his associates set up a fake moonshine still and called in a tip to the police department. And while Pusser and his deputies were out looking for it, they torched his car. So by this point, now the FBI was starting to get involved. This is mainly because an older couple named Dorothy and George were traveling through the area, and they just stopped at the Shamrock just to stop. They had ate, started feeling real tired, laid down. Turns out they were drugged. They realized that the next morning. They go knock on Louise's door. Louise, in the morning, still drunk as a skunk, opens the door, and the woman can see her purse sitting behind Louise. She was like, "You stole my shit. What the hell?" And Louise was like, "No." And they're like, "Obviously, that's ours." And she was like, "No, you can get the fuck off my property is what you can do." So they go to the sheriff. The sheriff gets there with warrants for theft and possession. And they literally find the purse sitting there. Yeah. She was like, "Here you go." They also raided it and found 2,200 half pints of moonshine. Sheriff Buford Pusser and Deputy Petey Plunk pulled up at the Shamrock with a warrant, and Louise was cursing them. You know, she was like, "I didn't steal anything. I don't know them." She tells the sheriff, "Listen, let me have a word with you. Come back into my cottage. I need to have a word with you." So he followed her down that hallway of her house, the one that Jack was brutally murdered in. And she opened the door to her bedroom. They both walked in, and she tried to push it shut behind her, but there was clothes hanging on it. You know when that happens, like you try to shut it, but there's clothes hanging on it. So Buford turns around right as she pulls what is called the 38 special from her apron pocket, and she fired from the hip. But she was drunk, so it missed him. And it went through the glass window, and it embedded itself in a wooden post outside the building. He fell to the bed, came out, and three consecutive shots were fired. Her gun misfired, and he shot three shots. Louise turned from him slightly. The first shot hit her in the back of the shoulder. Never dropping her gun, she was still cussing him. And before she could try to pull the trigger again, the third shot hit her directly in the head. Jim Moffat was the closest to the scene, and he actually opened the bedroom door right as the fatal shot came from Buford's gun. So it wasn't just them in there. Like, somebody actually witnessed this. The medical examiner, when he was examining her body, found a string with a pouch around her neck that contained $8,585. Staying in room 19, there was an undercover FBI agent. So he told him, he was like, "Listen, you cannot break my cover, but this is what happened." And it actually corroborated everything that Pusser and the other Deputy Petey Plunk, mm-hmm. It cleared him.
Okay.
And they actually took him to grand jury. He was completely cleared. Louise and Jack are both gone now. That leaves W.O. and Towhead. Towhead was a known friend of Kirksey Nick, who is the leader of the Dixie Mafia. Towhead escaped from prison. While he was in prison, had made comments about that he was going to take care of Pusser. Pusser was going to have it coming, and he was going to have 23 days of freedom to accomplish it. One night, Buford Pusser's out driving, and he sees a car that a taillight is out of. So he turns on his light and sirens, and inside were two women. One of these women was actually Towhead White in a wig. Before he knew what happened, the driver fired three shots at close range. Two bullets grazed his head, and the third hit him in the shoulder. January 3rd, 1967, Towhead surrendered to the FBI in something completely separate. People say he did this because he had found Louise's stash of cash, and he was turning himself in to hide from Nelson. Because we got to remember, Nelson's still the boss. He's still the one that's alive. So on August 12, 1967, Sheriff Pusser gets a call at his home saying that there was a drunk that needed to be checked out. His wife was nervous about him going alone at this point. A lot of bad shit had been going on, and she didn't like it. They were about to go on vacation. He said, "I'll come with you. We'll go to breakfast after. Then we'll go on vacation and everything will be fine." So they jump in their car, and they're going out to New Hope Road to check out a disturbance, which these drunken disorderly calls happen all the time, and they're never that complicated. It's normally pretty easy. He drives past the church where it was said to happen, and there was nobody there. Nothing was going on. But as he passed by, a Cadillac pulled out from behind the church and followed him with the lights off. As the two cars reached a narrow bridge, the Cadillac flashed on its headlights and came racing past Buford's car. The Cadillac opened fire, hitting Pauline in the head. So the sheriff ducked and stepped on the gas, and he sped up the road a couple of miles until he was away from it. And he pulled over to check on Pauline, and he had her head cradled in his lap. He was sitting there trying to help her. Reports say, honestly, praying that she would survive. The assassins found him, pulled up, and start shooting at him again, hitting Pusser in the face, blowing his jaw apart. It knocked him down, like, over on to her. And they actually found 14 casings at the second ambush site, and 11 of them actually hit the Plymouth. They thought he was dead by this point. Shit, I don't know how he wasn't dead by this point. But right. He grabs the radio and obviously doesn't have a jaw. Right. So he's trying to tell him what's going on. And the sheriff is on his way. He's trying to figure out where he was. He said it looked like the car had been through fucking war. It was horrible and it was bloody. Sadly, Pauline did not make it. She was dead on site. But Buford Pusser spent 18 days in the hospital and would have to have several surgeries to fix his jaw. And he couldn't come to her funeral because his jaw was literally, or like his face was held together by wire mesh. And some people criticized this poor man over the fact he didn't come to his wife's funeral.
They probably wouldn't let him out of the hospital. He's probably still in critical
condition. Yes! At first, Pusser declared he knew who was responsible.
Yeah, she died in his arms. I'm so sure that he didn't want to be there.
Right. So at first, he said he knew who was responsible. Towhead White, George McCann, Carmine Raymond, Gilardi, Gary McDaniel, and Kirk C. Nix. These names, one of these names will be a huge player in the story later on. He was in the hospital for 18 days and he had dozens and dozens of surgeries to repair his face. And at the end, he was like, you know what? I said it was them, but I'm not 100% sure at this point. Like, this has been very traumatic. So, during the research of the two cases before this one and then this one and the one after, I was reading like four books at the same time. And according to the book, Mississippi Mud, three ambush suspects all died mysteriously and Nix voluntarily went to prison to avoid Pusser. We'll talk more about that next episode with Kirksey. I don't want to ruin that. But let me tell you about these other folks. Obviously, they were all into, like, bad shit, right?
Right.
Carmine, who was supposedly, like, this big mafia hitman, said that it was found riddled with bullets floating in the Boston Harbor, right? But there are no news articles of that. That did not happen. There is one that is Carmen R. Gilardi. I think that's how you say it. But he was not found floating in the harbor. He was in prison for killing a man named Joe Lanza that was a bartender and was like, he was gathering intel for the police secretly. And the guy tried to escape. As he was trying to escape, he was apprehended and put in jail. But this guy was also rumored to be the Boston Strangler. He still to this day is suspect in the Boston Strangler case. And so, and at one point he was in the FBI's most wanted list, but there's no evidence that he was ever even in Tennessee or Mississippi. There would be no reason. It sounds like maybe he had heard the name in the news and he was kind of delirious at the time, but he actually died in 1975 in prison of a drug overdose. Gary McDaniel was another suspect in the ambush, one that he claimed. And his body was found floating in the Sabine River in Texas in 1969. But he was also like real deep into trouble with the Mississippi prosecutor. And Dixie Mafia thought that he was turning state evidence. So don't think Pusser. Obviously, people made rumors that like Pusser killed these men. But I think they just lived bad lives. I don't think he killed any of them. And then George McGann was a gambler, and he was killed during a poker game September 30th, 1970 in Texas. So I genuinely don't think that Pusser had anything to do with that. I think they were just shady people that he mentioned that died an unfortunate death.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you're caught up in shady shit's going to happen to you, you know?
Right. December 1967, Susan and her husband had been Christmas shopping, and they had gotten Susan's friend to watch baby Karen, their baby, for the day. Because they had had a lot going on. They've been fighting this legal battle with their crazy-ass mom, and then her crazy-ass mom died in the gunfight. It was just a lot going on, right? As Susan and Raymond walk through their kitchen doors, they hear someone yell, "Drop the packages." He marched them down the hall to their master bedroom, where he shot both of them in the head. Moments later, Peggy returned with Karen, and she was met in the driveway by Susan's cousin, who told her that she was going to watch Karen. So Peggy helped her put the baby in the car, and then Peggy left. Leaving Karen in the car, the cousin walks into the bloody scene. Susan was dead and Raymond was alive, only to die 3 hours later. Police were called, and Susan's cousin told the police that the couple were fighting and Raymond turned and shot his wife before committing suicide. The gun was on the bed and wasn't found near Raymond. And also, Raymond was right-handed and he was shot in his left temple. Karen was adopted by her dad's family, and that was ruled a murder-suicide. W.O. had hired a gunman to kill them. W.O. and Howard Bunch had a quick deed on all the Hathcock properties. In 1969, someone shot 8 times into Towhead's house, but he wasn't there at the time. At the same time, Southern crime lords were meeting together talking about the cleansing of the unwanted members, the bad members, the ones too much heat, right?
Yeah, drawing too much attention.
Unfortunately, Towhead was on the chopping block. He was too unpredictable.
So. He was like, he's killing everybody. I mean,
yeah, he's unpredictable. You can't trust him. So Nelson decided that Barry Jr. Smith, they called him Jr., owed him a favor. And the plan was hatched. Sherry Smith, Barry's wife, took Towhead out and got him drunk, and she was going to take him to the El Rey Motel where they had a sniper waiting on the roof. So, April 2nd, they spent the evening together, and they pulled up to this little El Rey Motel, and he pulled up to room number 3, and as soon as he pulled up and put the car in park, Towhead was shot in the forehead by a 30-30 rifle. Tommy Bivens came and pulled Shirley out of the car, shooting Towhead 6 more times. The police arrived on scene, but Junior Smith just said, "Hey, I killed him, but it's because he was drunk and he fired his gun at me first." Shirley was arrested for interfering with an investigation, but guess what? Charges were dropped. So around this same time is when they're making the movie Walking Tall with Buford Pusser. You know, this is becoming a huge deal. It actually profited over $2.5 million for the county. And it wasn't just one. There's multiple remakes and there's different versions. Around August 1974, he had actually gotten offered for the first time to play himself in one. This is going to be your story about you. So he was pretty excited about that. He actually had a brand new Corvette because he was doing ads for the local Corvette place. It had been acting weird and it had been in the mechanic shop for a few days. So one day he picked it up, goes home, picks up his daughter, Duana, and they go to the fair that evening. He plays basketball with some kids, and around 7 p.m. he seemed fine. But by around 10 o'clock, people were like, he slurred his words. You know, I think he might have been drinking. Just after midnight, Duana and Pusser are like, you know, we're going to go home. But Duana rides with her friend Jason, and Buford's driving his Corvette. And they actually leave before Buford does. And as they're driving, he just, boom, blows by him. Just blows by him. T-tops off, cruising. The car hits an embankment, causing his chin to hit the steering wheel, breaking his neck, and then ejecting him onto the shoulder. So a man who lived nearby looks out and he sees a car on fire. So he goes back in and he calls the police. Then when he makes it back out, Duana and Jason have pulled up and they've pulled him away from the car. Buford was dead on the scene. Obviously, rumors immediately begin to swirl. This was the mafia that killed him. His brake lines had been cut. There was actually 545 feet of skid marks on the highway. And they wonder if maybe he saw a deer run out, had tried to break for a deer. Nobody completely knows. But despite these claims, they say that he was drunk, he was driving too fast, and he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. That's ultimately what happened to him. Now, the state line main players are gone. Jack, Louise, their daughter, Toehead, Buford Pusser, they're all gone. So that leaves us now, the next episode, The Crescendo, Kirk C. Nix, the leader of the Dixie Mafia. Bum, bum, bum. And now after these three episodes, you see why I have to, I was like, I can't just tell them about the Dixie Mafia. Like, I have to start at the beginning. They have to know how the Dixie Mafia became the Dixie Mafia. All right, next week, Dixie Mafia, my lifelong dream. Thanks, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.